The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Fesh up. Will the Irish dancing scandal be probed by an Oireachtas committee? Candle in the wind. Should we prepare for blackouts this winter? And what lies beneath? Who is protecting the pipes and cables running under Irish waters? We'll have all of that and more on tonight's Late Debate. And joining us in studio tonight, we have Barry Andrews, Fianna Fáil MEP and member of the Renew Europe Group, Senator John McGahan, Fine Gael Seanad spokesperson on climate and natural resources, Rory O'Murchu, Sinn Féin TD for Louth and party spokesperson on communications and broadband, Independent Senator Tom Clonan, and Christina Finn, political correspondent with The Journal. We want to hear from you as well, so get in touch. Text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie, or you can tweet to @LateDebateRTE. Now, a lot around today, actually, at the end of the week. Christina, talk to us for a minute about this eviction ban chatter that has erupted again. Paul McAuliffe calling for it on the floor of the Dáil. We know some of his Fianna Fáil colleagues were pushing for it at last night's Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party meeting. And the Taoiseach was asked about it today and didn't entirely rule it out.
Yeah, so this has kind of been rumbling under the surface for a number of weeks now, where a lot of opposition members have been calling, obviously, for an eviction ban for some time. But even within the coalition parties, there have been concerns raised from TDs who have been facing what they have described as a tsunami of constituents coming into their offices day in, day out with notice to quit, notices that are going to come to pass into the winter months and into the new year. And the question is, I suppose, where is the rental properties for these people to go? The question was put to Micheál Martin at the Ardèche over the weekend, and he was raising things about striking a balance, obviously, between supply issues with landlords, constitutional issues as well. And it was asked of him again while he was over in Prague, was there any further considerations given to it? And he said that it was being kept under review. So what he sort of described was, at the time of the pandemic, we had obviously the eviction ban because the certain circumstances were in place that we couldn't leave our home past 5 kilometres. There was a lot of restrictions on movement, and that there was a certain bar that was met that allowed the government to take that action. He's saying now that perhaps, you know, when the calls for it in the last number of weeks was more focused on the supply issue, there seems to be perhaps a pivot towards the cost of living crisis, the energy crisis, the insurmountable... Okay,
that the circumstances may once again be in place to allow us to be described as the emergency circumstances.
Yeah, if they can pass that bar. Now, Dara Brian has been in discussion with the Attorney General to see if that bar can be met.
And so those whether discussions are ongoing.
Yes.
But that's not what Leo Varadkar said when he was asked about it.
Yeah, Leo Varadkar perhaps maybe not as delicately put it in the Dáil today, saying that, look, if an eviction ban is brought in, we're really just storing up the problem. And he's saying the reason why we have the issue right now with a lot more notice to quit and evictions taking place is because people would have been evicted all those months ago. I suppose the argument is the whole point of an eviction ban is to give people that extra time, that extra space. If they know they're going to be kicked out of their house or their apartment, at least they have months, weeks to save, to get plans in place rather than, you know, coming up to the Christmas months and facing nowhere to live.
Barry Andrews, is this an idea whose time has come again?
Yeah, well, I think the Taoiseach's indicated that they're going down that road, and the right to private property in the Constitution is obviously limited to the common good. And, you know, circumstances arose during the COVID pandemic where that balance was struck in favour of tenants, and quite rightly so. And clearly, the extent of the pressure on tenants right now may well trigger the same balance to be struck. So the Attorney General is looking at that right now. And I'm sure, knowing Dara O'Brien as I do and the issues that have been raised by Fianna Fáil backbenchers, that it may well be something that will be legislated for. As far as what the Taoiseach had to say in the Dáil, I think it's a point, you know. It doesn't mean to say that he's against the idea, but it is a point that you
to be basically saying he's not in favour of it. I mean, I didn't know if you'd say he wasn't against the idea, but he pretty much did rule it out. He doesn't agree with it.
I didn't hear it that way. I mean, it was a debate. You know, we don't have a proposal. in front of the cabinet. We haven't analysis done by the departments, by the Attorney General. At the moment, it's conceptually very vague as a proposal, and therefore it needs to be debated. And the argument, therefore, is, yes, you're only storing up problems. We're not going to actually solve the problem of tenants in arrears. You're simply going to kick it, that can down the road. So that's an issue that has to be tackled in the context of this debate.
OK, John, how did you hear what the Taoiseach just said? Well, and is there the same kind of clamour on the backbenches and in the Fine Gael parliamentary party that we're hearing there is in the Fianna Fáil parliamentary party for a move on this?
Well, I didn't hear what the Taoiseach said today, so I got a bit more information from Christina there. But so I'm basing off what I've heard here in the last few minutes. But I think that, and I certainly wouldn't say the Taoiseach has ruled it out based on what I've heard. But I think it is there to be debated. And if Dara O'Brien, the Minister, and the Attorney General are going to thrash this out, let's get some more detail about it. It's just been floated in the last day or two. So I think it would be...
been talking about it for months, John.
Well, I look at it there with the type of people who come into my constituency office, and there's two sides to it. On one level, there are landlords who really take the biscuit and treat tenants very, very poorly and evict them for any sort of a reason. But on the flip side, there also are a number of tenants who I have come across that have huge amount of money owed to landlords that haven't paid rent or anything like that for a vast number of months. And that those landlords, who are law-abiding, decent people at the same time, have a very tough time in trying to get someone out of a home that shouldn't be there in the first place. So I have seen both sides of it in my own office at home in Dundalk. And I think there has to be a certain sense of fair play both towards tenants and both towards landlords. And when further discussion comes about it, when there's more detail about it, I think then will be a good idea to see whether it's something that could be introduced or not.
Tom Clonan.
Oh, goodness. I mean, I think this is a crisis similar to the pandemic. I recall a couple of weeks ago hearing that on daft.ie, there was something like 150 or so properties available for rent for a population of 5 million people. So if we evict people, I mean, effectively, they've nowhere to go. And then they become, I mean, apart from the personal tragedy of that, and it, but it places a further burden on the state.
Yeah, because I think that's what the Simon community and Focus Ireland were at pains to stress in the run up to the budget, that we have no more emergency accommodation. Yeah, that is not there as an option anymore. So what is going to happen as we go into it?
This is an unprecedented time, and I'm glad to hear that there was a debate and that there was a discussion. And I'd agree with Barry that I know from my interactions with all parties and other independents that there is a kind of a collective desire to sort this out. And, you know, but with the crisis caused by the war in Ukraine in terms of energy prices, cost of living and the pressure on accommodation, because we're taking in all of our friends from Ukraine because they have nowhere else to go. So I think it's probably a good time to have this conversation. But personally, I would be very much in favour of a moratorium on evictions.
On evictions
until we begin to turn this thing around, however long that takes.
This is Sinn Féin policy, obviously. Rory?
Like this just needs to happen as soon as possible. Look, everyone accepts at this point in time we're in a cost of living crisis, an energy crisis, but we've had a housing crisis for a long time. And I think what we're talking about is it's a no-fault. It's that there would be a ban on no-fault evictions. There still has to be some sort of capacity in relation to dealing with antisocial behaviour and non-payment. They fall into a different bracket. But you're right, there is no emergency accommodation. See the short-term fixes that when people would come into our office that even some of our councillor would spend, I'll say Kevin Meenan in Dundalk would spend a huge amount of time dealing directly with rental agencies. He would have a relationship built up. But like you're trying to deal with a macro problem in a client list way, and he would just say, no, we don't have that capacity to do that. So look, simple as this, we need to ensure that eviction ban is in, but we also have other things to do. We know the prices are unsustainable at this point in time. We need a ban on increases, and we did welcome the fact that there was a tax credit, but I think it doesn't work without the fact of a ban on any increases. And then beyond that,
yeah, you're saying that will end up increasing.
And we've always said it's insufficient in relation to the problem that we're dealing with at the minute.
Okay. The Taoiseach was out talking about a lot of things today, Christina. He did a very lengthy doorstep in UCD as well. Just very quickly, on the disconnections issue, the disconnections for pay as you go, customers. Where are we now with that? Because this seems to be rumbling on and on.
Yeah, it's a bit of a complicated one, I think, for the government to sort of get to grasp with, because we've had Minister Eamon Ryan has been meeting energy companies today, yesterday, and apparently has more meetings planned in the coming weeks to sort of deal with this pay-as-you-go issue. I'm a pay-as-you-go meter person, so I have sometimes, I've said, been remiss at topping up my meter sometimes, and you get that text through to you to say that, you know, your meter is really low, top up by 2 p.m. or you're at risk of disconnection. That's fine for me. I go onto the app, I can top it up, no problem, and get on with the rest of my day. But the issue, I suppose, is what do people do when they don't have that money? Now, I put that to the Taoiseach yesterday in a press conference. And he was at pains to sort of list off a lot of the supports that the government have put in place in terms of, you know, the credits, the energy credit, mm-hmm. that people shouldn't get into that situation. But if they do, there's emergency social welfare supports, there's MABs and all the rest. But the point is, I suppose, there is a bit of a different situation with a pay-as-you-go customer, because you only have that time-limited window in which you can either get onto the company, ring your social welfare officer and try and get it all sorted. So Leo Varadkar was saying that extra protections were being put in place and he wanted to see equity across all customers, be you a bill pay, a pay-as-you-go, and also he wanted to tackle the issue of switching. So if you're a pay-as-you-go customer, there's something like €160 charge if you want to change to become a bill payer.
Yeah,
so he wants to get rid of that so people might have the option. But like, this isn't just, I suppose, it's kind of been painted a lot as in it's a lot of vulnerable people are on pay-as-you-go meters. I've lived in a rental accommodation for years and majority of apartment blocks have pay-as-you-go meters. It's not just a vulnerable issue.
Oh, yeah, well, Barry Ward was sitting in the chair. You were sitting in the studio last night and he's on pay-as-you-go as well. But Eamon Ryan is meeting with energy companies today. So they are trying to come up with some way of organising.
Yeah, and there should be a mechanism. I think Varadkar said in the Dáil today, he was pointing out that, you know, you can't actually have a disconnection if you're a pay-as-you-go meter holder during the weekend. You know, I've had that before as well, where they say, you know, don't worry, come, you know, if you sort this out by Monday, that's fine. So there must be a mechanism in place that if you can't be disconnected during the weekend, then there must be a mechanism where you just can't be disconnected straight away.
Yeah, and I do think, well, I understand that it depends on what energy company you are dealing with and the systems that they're on. But anyway, we will keep an eye on that because it's a hugely important issue for a lot of people. And we will talk about energy in a wider sense in a minute. But I just wanted to get on to the story, I think, that has everyone talking today, which is the allegations of cheating in Irish dancing Feisne. Do we have any Irish dancers in the studio?
Well, I did Irish dance for at least 3 weeks. And I do remember when my father called me out, because he actually had won a number of medals or whatever. Now, I don't think he was anything too spectacular himself, but he was less than impressed with myself. And I think that was the last that I ever did Irish
you
dancing.
You were pulled out of it after three short weeks.
Yeah, so I don't think there's any big question in relation to any of my wins. But look, in fairness, this is a very serious issue. Look, we know the importance of Irish dancing from a point of view of selling Ireland. We know the huge money that's involved, even from a business point of view and all the rest of it. And then we get the idea, if we're talking about sport or anything, of absolute fairness for everyone that's involved.
Yeah, but it's not just about fair. I mean, really, I think the killer, what you just said there, the huge money, it's a very lucrative business.
Yeah.
And a lot of the money follows the successful schools.
Oh, that's it. It's worth your while to be a winner.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, there should be no surprise that there's cheating in competition. Every sport, the more professional it is, the more cheating there seems to be in it. And the more money that's involved, the more propensity for cheating. And therefore, you need very, very strong regulation. The Guardian ran some other pieces about the fact that there's cheating allegations in chess, there's cheating allegations in fishing, in angling, where people are putting weights into the catch. So, you know, this is not necessarily surprising. I wouldn't go so far as to say that it's a reputational issue for Ireland. Yes, we have to take it seriously.
Was that overstating it, do you think?
I feel so. You know, there's competition. There's cheating in competition all over the world in every type of sport where there's a lot at stake. And well, therefore, a lot has to be done to take care to regulate against
these. I think we do have to get to the bottom of it. And in fairness, like you've seen the commentary that have been made in relation to...
I feel it's really, really invested in this.
George is looking at
talking about the chess.
But beyond that, like the fact is, and we have the Arts and Culture Committee looking at taking in on commission Laurinkee Gaelica. I have to admit that's an organisation I didn't realise existed until today. But we all get the importance of it, so we just need to move this on as quickly as possible, because they have accepted themselves that there's that they have huge reputational damage done. So we need to find out what the story is and then basically ensure that we fix this up as regards it's not an ongoing issue.
You know, I think there's a risk of it becoming a reputational issue, because as we said on the way in here, I saw the New York Post has an article on it.
The Guardian. Like it's everywhere.
So, you know, it is something...
It's kind of an irresistible story, though.
Exactly. It's Irish dancing, Ireland, you know, some
ringlets,
sort of... Yeah, it writes itself, weights. Really. But, yeah, but, you know, I do think unless... it does feel like something that could get legs unless there was...
No pun intended.
I actually didn't mean that, but...
Yeah. But I think it's a very vulnerable cohort of people. Like in the main, it's young girls and boys, and we've seen from what's happened in swimming and other sports that when you have that type of pressure and exploitation of people, that it can lead to darker abuses. And already I'm seeing reports of sexual favours being involved.
That's at teacher level, though, not a student. And I just want to be very careful, Tom. That's not the allegation that we're talking about today.
From my own experience of these matters, these are alarm bells, and I think we need to take it seriously. And I should also add, I am a professional dancer. And I did perform with Junk Ensemble in an award-winning dance performance.
Tom Slonin, tell us more.
And I do know, this is Junk Ensemble.
We had,
yeah, absolutely. Out in the car park.
Probably. I might need to
But I know that, you know, the precision and the fitness and the hard work that goes into this. And to hear...
It's a sport, really, for a lot of the young people, you know, particularly that age group.
But it's a cultural activity.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think... we need to get to the heart of it. But I would be worried about that particular demographic, that particular cohort, because they are a vulnerable group. And, you know, alarm bells there for me.
And really certainly. Upsetting, I think, for like those people that have actually put in the graft and perhaps not won the competitions and now are probably sitting at home questioning this whole story and wondering, you know, could I have been at a different position than I should have been?
That's the thing. And I know, like,
I thought you were going to stay out of this one, John.
But to be serious about it, like, I know it's a story that can be easy to kind of laugh at the very start. Mm. But this is a really distressing story for people who are involved in Irish dancing right across this country. And while I know it's easy to kind of joke and laugh about it because there's maybe a perceived sense of humour to it, Irish dancing, whether we like it or not, has a very strong role to play in this country. There are people that take it very, very seriously. And allegations of cheating in any sort of sport are utterly wrong. And I think one of the good things that has come out of this is that there's a retired judge who's been appointed to this, so it's been taken very seriously.
Yeah.
And I would really hope that once that investigation has taken place, that those who are responsible for cheating, because cheating is wrong in all walks of life, is disciplined properly about this, because it is reputational damage.
Of course, and obviously we don't want to make light of something, because as you say, this is a huge part of a lot of people's lives. So it is a very serious matter.
With incredibly serious allegations.
And the allegations are very serious. But we leave it there for that, because I want to get on to go back to the energy question, because that's obviously going to be a story that we will not be able to get away from, I think, as we come into the weeks and months ahead. Energy security was on the agenda again today, and I think we can hear Leo Varadkar, who again had something to say about this today. He was asked about warning from EirGrid today that demand will outstrip supply over the next 10 years. And this is what he had to say about fears of blackouts.
While nobody can rule out the possibility of blackouts over the winter, you know, I do want to say to families, to homeowners, to small businesses, to farms, the chances of a blackout or a prolonged blackout affecting them is very low. And I think a lot of people are engaging in worrying people about this. We can't rule it out. But the risk of having that kind of blackout is very low, because if we do enter a red alert scenario, it is the large energy users that come offline first, like the data centres, for example.
Yeah, so that was Leo Varadkar talking about If I'm hearing him right, he's basically saying the risk is low, and if there will be a blackout, it'll probably be a short blackout. Is that a reasonable?
Well, the chief executive of Airgrid, Mark Foley, today said that it would require a remarkable confluence of circumstances to trigger blackouts in Ireland this winter. For example, very, very low temperatures over the winter. Very low wind, obviously low renewable generation. Similar circumstances in the UK, so the interconnectors aren't available to us, and various other factors before there would be a blackout. So yes, we have to prepare for this. We have to prepare for the worst and hope for the best. But the clear indication from Airgrid today was that it seems a remote possibility, and that we will have blackouts this winter.
And just in relation to how we would compare to other European countries, is this something that there is a lot of talk about in Brussels?
There's a lot of talk about energy security, of course, but generation is an issue for Ireland. It is, unfortunately, we have to face up to this reality. It is an issue for us. Generation isn't an issue in a lot of countries. And, you know, we have to, there's no point in trying to walk a circle around this issue. It is a problem for us.
And whose fault is that?
Well, it's a fault of, you know, we had the ESB who used to be responsible for all of this. It was deregulated. Airgrid and CRU are responsible with the government for the generation of, for all the policy that's required to make sure that we're properly provided for. And we were unfortunate, I have to say, on two things. First of all, there was a bid, as we all know, in 2019, that didn't come through for gas generation. And equally, the war in Ukraine is exacerbating the price issue. So it's causing a serious issue for Ireland right now. But I'm afraid to say some of it is of our own making.
Yeah, we've obviously had a generation difficulty or a lack of capacity. Like, this has been highlighted from at least 2016 in serious enough terms. There was an auction system, like ESB and others stated that they would be able to provide a certain level of capacity, but they will state due to planning difficulties and others, they weren't able to follow through in relation to that. So we ended up in a scenario where we weren't going to be able to have that as a solution. And then the difficulty for Airgrid, because like last year, we were already in the situation where the reports had been made and our capacity and our need for generation was found that we were going to need a greater level. And we at that stage, Airgrid should have been facilitated from a point of view that they could actually go out and that they could get that backup capacity. When they tried to do it, it was found that they couldn't actually do it. We had to deal with last minute legislation at the end of the last Dáil term that really should have happened the year before. So it is an abject failure. It is on the state. It is on the government. But we are now in a situation where obviously we will eventually get that generation capacity, but it will be no good for this winter. There is an element we might be depending on demand reduction from, you know what I mean, data centres and probably across industry. This would have reputational damage in relation to Ireland as a good place to do business.
Yeah, so that, I mean, that was the point as well that the Taoiseach was making today, that, you know, one of the reasons he was telling people not to worry is that if there were to be some rationing, that it would be the big energy users that would be asked to turn on their own generators or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that would, as Rory said, would be reputationally very damaging, surely, for Ireland.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things to unpack there. I might touch on blackouts in a second, but I want to, well, let me touch on blackouts first and let me come back to the data centres. In terms of blackouts, it's to go along with what Andrew said there.
Barry, sorry.
I'm thinking of your predecessors. But the point is, the prospect of blackouts are so remote for the points that Barry outlined it there, that you would need so many things to happen at a certain time on a certain day. So those things are exactly what Barry said. No wind on a particular time and day. Exceptionally cold spell and even higher demand for electricity than what we're even thinking of. You then need some sort of massive problem with like infrastructure where the interconnector between Ireland and Britain isn't working, or that there's some sort of problem with a power connection. So you need an extraordinary amount of things to happen all at a particular time to have blackouts. Even the Airgrid with their winter outlook report said that while the margins between supply and demand are tight this winter and they will be tighter than last winter, the chances of blackouts are very, very marginal, if not a very remote possibility. Now, absolutely, you have to prepare for everything, because the day you don't prepare for something is the day something catastrophic happens. But I really don't want the concept of scaremongering or people thinking blackouts are going to happen, because before the Oireachtas Committee with the Climate Action Committee a couple of weeks ago, it was all about blackouts, blackouts, blackouts. The prospect of blackouts happening this winter are so remote for the reasons I outlined, and I would fully agree, naturally enough, with the comments of my party
leader
earlier today.
Yeah, we are discussing, John, that warning from Airgrid that demand will outstrip supply for the next 10 years. That is not a small thing.
But for the next 10 years. But let's talk about the next couple of weeks and the next couple of months facing into this
winter. Well, let's talk about the next 10 years.
Well, we can talk about the next 10 years, but I think people are really concerned what's going to happen over the next couple of weeks and this winter that we're facing into. And as Airgrid themselves have said, that the margins between supply and demand are tight. They're tighter than last year, but they're tight enough that we can manage it. Just to move back onto the point of data centres.
Very quickly, because I want to let the rest of
the just to move back onto the point of data centres. I think data centres have been a red herring in this entire debate for the last couple of months, and for a couple of reasons, and happy to debate it. First of all, no data centres have been built in this country since 2020. Any future data centres that are going to be built are going to have to rely on renewable energy to power them. A lot of current data centres in this country are already making that transition to renewable energy in the first place. And the final thing about it is, and this is one of the key things that we're talking about energy security this year, is that if there is a situation where the system is getting overloaded, data centres are able to come off the grid straight away, and that will provide a lot of space for domestic use at the same time.
Data centres are a total red herring, Tom Clough.
It's predicted that data centres will consume 1/3 of our total electricity.
Currently at 17%,
By 2030. But look, Airgrid have raised this issue, and you know, I concur with everybody who said, like, we've known about this, but I would say this. This year we have what's called a triple dip El Nino in the Pacific, and that's associated with colder winters. And the World Meteorological Organization and the British Meteorological Service have all issued, sort of insofar as they can, an observation that this could impact on this winter and the following winter. So there is a risk that we could have a colder than usual winter, however slim that risk is. But, you know, I think the generation issue masks the wider issue of our over-reliance on gas. And perhaps the war in Ukraine will propel us in the right direction in increasing that 30% wind energy up higher. But I would say this, in previous winters, prior to COVID, the government had the Winter Ready program, and they were very good at communicating, you know, what the, you know, the provisions might be for the coming winter. And I think it would be a good idea, like it was during COVID, with the cost of living crisis and the energy crisis and so on, to reconvene the National Emergency Coordination Centre. And just, even if it's once every fortnight, have a press conference like they did with MFET, and tell the people what is the plan for the winter, so that all of this anxiety and distress and worry about
it. Potentially add to our anxiety,
Information is power, and it empowers people, gives them the, you know, tools. Like, I would be thinking of people with disabilities, people who have nebulizers in their homes, people who are, you know, trying to survive on the increase to €220 per week. This kind of conversation is terrifying for them. But if you have a very clear message from government, like we had during COVID with NFET and so on, I think that would be helpful. And the government did this in the past, during the Beast from the East, and things we learned from the coal snap that we had in 2010, that kind of communication has improved. The skill sets are there. I think it would be no harm to convene that centre and just tell the people what the plan is, so that they don't have to worry and be concerned in a vacuum.
Fundamentally, just tell people there is a plan, or there are people in place.
There is a plan, and it's called the National Energy Security Framework. A plan exists, and it's a 60-page document. I looked at it 2 hours ago, and it provides for every single scenario that may happen in relation to gas, oil, electricity. A plan exists and will be rolled out if the unforsaken happens.
But what we're dealing with is over, I think it's the last five years, is a 9% increase in demand, as in the use of energy within the state. That hasn't happened anywhere across Europe. That's down to data centres and obviously and other particular factors. But I think it's fair to say everyone's talking about renewables. Like, we've probably been asleep for the last 10 years in relation to delivering particularly offshore wind and solar. And see, if we were to do that, we would obviously be in a far better place in relation to not only this, but in relation to the particular situation we find ourselves as regards energy supply because of the circumstance of the Russian invasion. So, like, okay. John was speaking about, obviously, the Climate Change Committee. They recently, to look at offshore wind, went on a trip to Scotland because Scotland made different decisions than we actually did and basically
and way
did
ahead
the business.
Of us now.
Exactly.
And Sinn Féin had a bill last year. Sinn Féin had a bill last year to ban wind farms in Ireland, put forward by Brian Stanley.
This is, look, so
let's
talk
about it. If you want to be serious, let's be serious.
I want you to pretty ban.
Can I have one voice, please? Can I have one voice? And I let Barry.
Just want to bring, you know, you asked at the beginning about Europe and what's the comparison, and I acknowledge there's a generation problem here. There isn't really a demand problem. We're trying to talk about data centers as the problem here, and a 9% increase, any country in Europe would take our arm off to have the economic growth that we've had in this country, and the low unemployment that we've had in this country over the last 5 years.
We didn't plan for it.
Sorry, and that has been a key factor in the growth of demand for electricity. And the Airgrid chief executive pointed out today that that shouldn't have been a problem. The problem is generation. So the increase in demand, blaming data centres, I agree with John, it is a red herring.
So we should be blaming the government for not planning, I think
I began by acknowledging that. Actually, I said Airgrid, the Commission for Regulation of Utilities and the government have to take responsibility for the situation.
But
it's not the data centre. That's my...
Will the government be asking the public not to use Christmas lights this year on Christmas trees and houses to save energy? We're being asked.
I find that hard to take seriously, you know, because, I mean, there's so many people suffering some serious problem, not just in Ireland, but across the world about generated by these issues. And when I hear people worried about electric, Christmas lights, I find that... it's so irrelevant, you know, to this discussion. People are suffering in such a very profound way.
It's not irrelevant when people are talking about the struggles that they're going through, and then they're hearing about the green lighting of massive projects coming on the grid without the capacity. And then talking about, I know, as we're saying, that there's a low... Like data centres, we have nine...
No data centres have been built since 2020.
We have 9 or 10 in planning permission ready to go.
But one of the stipulations of that planning permission is they'll have to use renewable energy.
I take a real issue with people saying that, like, I heard someone on the radio saying that from, if you look from space, the 9% increase in electricity growth, that we're a beacon over Europe. Like, nobody in the real life cares about that. Do you know what I mean? Like, people in real life care about whether they can turn on their cooker, whether just because there's a data center been built that they can actually, you know, turn on the lights. Yes, data centers, I think, have been used sometimes as a bit of a scapegoat, but there is a bigger issue here about green lighting, massive, huge projects. Like, I drove past a data center on my way here tonight, lit up like a Christmas
planning regulations,
and the way to talk about an energy
the
crisis.
Nine or ten,
do you know what I mean?
The 9 or 10 places.
We need to get real here.
The 9 or 10 places you mentioned there, based under planning regulations and law, will have to use renewable energy. So, like, that's the way we're moving with it. So that's why I think it's a red herring.
But the fact is, John, we haven't planned in relation to delivering for that 9% increase, and that is something that needs to happen. And I think it's absolutely fair. The only thing that people care is that the supply is there, that they switch on the lights when they need them, that they have them, and that it's at a price that they can afford.
Okay. Can I just say another point as well about the capacity generation that was promised to come online that didn't? That there's been little debate about restructuring that whole tendering process, that people can come in and say, yeah, not a bother, I'm here to bring that generation, that capacity in 3 or 4 or 5 years time, and then not deliver it. And they get little or no sanctions, barely a slap on the hand for it. And here we are, and it leaves the state in the
totally high and dry
that it is.
Speaking about, you know, what people care about and, you know, when you switch it on, it will be there. Gas is another serious issue, and in terms of the security of supply for gas and the fact that we are so dependent on that interconnector, and we saw what has just happened with the Nord Stream gas pipeline. Should we be worried, Tom Clonan, should we be worried about how vulnerable we are in terms of our dependency on that source of gas. And we now know that, you know, there are bad actors out there that could deliberately attack it.
Well, I mean, the overarching concern about the supply, but if you mean, should we be concerned about the security of the physical infrastructure on the seabed?
Well, both, really. The fact that we are so dependent on a very particular piece of infrastructure that could be vulnerable.
Well, Ireland, you know, we're unique in that we have obviously gas and electricity interconnectors on our seabed, but we also have 19 fibre optic oceanic cables in our waters, actually coming ashore, that carry about one third of the internet traffic and data between the United States and the European Union. Yeah. And then the other cables that come from Europe also pass through our territorial waters. And we are the only country in the European Union that cannot monitor its seabed and can't intervene there. So it is a risk. The European Union has asked all of its member states to increase the security around their critical infrastructure because of the asymmetrical hybrid warfare that is being conducted by Russia under, it's called the Gerasimov doctrine. So we have to be mindful of it. Unfortunately,
what can we do though? We don't have any capability.
Well, we don't. But I suppose, though, you know, in fairness to the government, that you know, the Commission on the Future of Defence Forces, the Minister for Defence, Simon Coveney, has approved and it has been, you know, launched a major investment into our maritime and air assets to try and help us in that regard. But it, I suppose, it does bring into focus the fact that we haven't invested over the years. But one thing that we could do immediately to protect the kind of skill sets that we do have for air and naval personnel is to deal with the pay and conditions issue, to keep personnel, pay our sailors and soldiers and aircrew, pay them a living wage. And that would stop the exodus from our defence forces, which is a key component to ramping up that security.
Yes, Barry. Yeah. Barry Andrews.
Just on the undersea cables, I think our, you know, from a European perspective, the European Parliament published a report that in June which looked at undersea cable vulnerability across the EU. And of course, the maritime countries were mentioned more, but Ireland was mentioned 28 times in this report because of the degree of vulnerability and the lack of any proper defence forces capability, the naval or air service. So, you know, one of the things we need to really look at is our neuralgia around cooperation on military and security and defence issues with other EU countries.
What do you mean by neuralgia?
Well, we're very nervous about cooperating on something like PESCO, for example. I mean, we had to walk very carefully into PESCO, which is in the Lisbon Treaty. We all voted for it.
I don't think Rory voted for it.
Well, he may not have voted. In fact, Sinn Féin never voted for any change to the constitutional architecture of the European Union, including accession in 1972. So if Sinn Féin didn't vote against it, that doesn't mean anything, frankly. But what we do need to do is to look at cooperation with our European colleagues, because for all the investment that is possible, and we should do, and pay our soldiers and our defence forces properly, we would be much better off cooperating with other member states and with the UK.
Who already have that capability.
Absolutely, sure. We're very good at with peacekeeping. We've been doing it since the Congo in the early 60s. That's where our strengths are. Why not we cooperate?
Not great with the submarines, though.
Not great.
There's a basic capacity, and look, Tom spoke about that we need to have at a defence forces level. In fairness, the Minister for Foreign Affairs was answering questions in relation to this, today. And we are in that period of dealing with hybrid asymmetrical warfare and those particular attacks. We also have the huge issue in relation to cyber. In some cases, you know, someone doesn't even have to physically make contact to do real damage. We've seen that in the last while.
Indeed.
We even saw where it accidentally happened in relation to Aer Lingus, because there was works going on and literally somebody cut a cable and the backup didn't work, and you knocked out a situation where 31,000 people were impacted in relation to delayed flights and not able to are not able to make flights at all. And look, we know that we're wide open. So when I spoke to Minister Coveney today, the question really was, it's an audit in relation to all our vulnerabilities, and that we just look at what are sensible solutions. And yeah, some of this will involve an element of cooperation, which is already happening in the field of cyber anyway at this point in time. And we're probably in a slightly better place than we were previously, in the sense that the NCSC has a greater level of funding.
Would Sinn Féin be relaxed about that kind of military cooperation?
Well, I think everyone is quite clear in relation to Sinn Féin's position, and I think that was reiterated today, and even the Taoiseach stated it, that here, nobody expects us to be any sort of military superpower. We need to have an audit in relation to what our vulnerabilities are. We will look at what we're going to deal with, and then we'll see what solutions make sense for Ireland.
Okay, just another text in there. What you were saying there, basically, Rory, we don't take defence sufficiently seriously. We need to look at the potential of cyber attacks. We need to talk about potential attacks on our digital infrastructure. And talking about our digital infrastructure, John, is it not surprising that we're not getting more blowback from the Googles and the Amazons and the, our big tech here, worried about the potential absolute catastrophe if one of those cables or any number of those cables were taken out?
Yeah, and I think there's two things. First of all, in terms of the undersea cables, we have a responsibility alongside other EU member states to make sure that we are protecting international infrastructure. Simon Coveney was very, very serious about that. But the two follow-on
points... But we're not, though, are we?
Well, we are, and I'll tell you why we are. Because of last week in the budget, where we had the highest amount of capital expenditure in the defence forces.
Yeah, but nothing about...
Nothing
in relation to capital spending that would directly deal with this issue.
No, but the point is, there's 1.1 billion allocated to the defence forces.
But how are
an
we
increase
able to,
of 67 million.
But I'm genuinely interested to know if there is... Are we doing anything?
Yeah,
have we any capacity secure this infrastructure?
So two things. First of all, because of that increase in funding, that is going to allow us to get to the same level of military capabilities as other European countries of our size. So it is the highest amount of funding imaginable, and it is going to go a long way towards trying to look at deficiencies that we have in our defence forces, like this type of monitoring. But to go back to the point that Barry made earlier, I think we need to have, and perhaps it's one thing about the war in Ukraine, that it has sparked a debate around Ireland's defence policy over the last year. And what I would say towards it is that it's a foolish idea for people in Ireland to have this concept of, because we're Ireland and everybody likes us and we're on the edge of the European continent, nothing bad will happen to us. I think we need to have a very mature and grown-up conversation about what type of defence policy we want and what type of cooperation policy we want with other EU member states. And I think that is the debate that I would certainly welcome.
And would you sort of dilute our neutral status, neutrality?
I think everything should be, I've been very clear on that in the past. I think everything should be up for debate. We have had some very big
debates.
Even
our neutrality?
Why not? Because we've had some very big national conversations in the last couple of years, like marriage equality, like abortion. Neutrality as well should be on the table for discussion. There's nothing to be feared from a debate. Absolutely nothing. And the final thing I would say is neutrality isn't sacrosanct. It's not some sort of sacred cow that no one can discuss. Let's have the conversation and let's see what people think about it.
I think though, you know, when we're relying on the Royal Air Force to patrol our controlled airspace.
I was going to say, John is saying, we're going to be up at the level of every other EU country of our size. Do you see that happening? Are we actually at that level?
To be fair to John and to be fair to the Minister, Simon Coveney, I mean, he came into the Shannon during the week and set out in some detail what the plan was, and he expects to close the considerable gaps that are there by 2028. And I know that's 5-6 years hence, but at least they're doing something. But at the moment, we're provocatively weak. The Russians sent a surveillance ship, the Antar, into our waters in 2021. It was tracked, it was surveilled. We've had an increase in Russian naval activity, and thanks to the Southwest Fisheries Organization, they sent them packing.
And they were at the exact
spot where those cables go off down off the
shelf,
down to the Atlantic shelf. So, you know, they are watching us, but they're also sending a message to NATO. They're saying, look, this is your weakest spot. We're doing something about that. But that, in my mind, is not a reason for Ireland to join a military alliance. Now, we can be politically supportive of Ukraine and we can do everything within our power to support them. And as members of Partnership for Peace and the European Military structures. We have participated in peace enforcement in Africa, we've participated in NATO missions in Afghanistan and in Kosovo. So we can pick and choose the conflicts we want to get involved in as an independent, neutral country. What we should not do is join a military alliance, because the minute we do that, we go from being a very, very unique, and we have a great contribution to make in the world stage. We would go from that to being 0.0001% of NATO strength, and we would lose our voice immediately.
And this texter is saying, so we make ourselves a target by siding with NATO, etc.
Exactly. Look, in fairness, I have to agree with an awful lot of what Tom has said. Like, I don't think this is the time that we need to sacrifice our non-alignment. We have operated as a straight player, been seen as a straight player. That's the reason, one of the reasons we have our position on the UN Security Council. It doesn't make any sense that we would put ourselves into the breach with NATO. Look, see, outside of the situation and circumstances that we find ourselves in as regards the Russian invasion, would you stand over any position that had been taken by the American military or NATO in over the last 20, 30, 40 years? It would have been very difficult to do.
But Rory's dead right. The last 20 years, NATO has been a disgrace, and I wouldn't advocate joining NATO. But what's happened since the Russian invasion is there's no way Ukraine would still be on the pitch if they were only relying on European military support. It's only because of American military support. And what they're doing is defending democracy in Europe, in our neighbourhood. They're defending democracy in our neighbourhood. It's not us that's doing it. So we really have to, if we're serious about the European project, if Lamas said, if it's worth having, it's worth defending, it's under assault. I know I don't believe that Russia is a conventional threat to Ireland. They're not even a conventional threat to Ukraine. Been kicked out of half of Ukraine already. So, but I do think we have to have a discussion around European defence, because, you know, Trump could be back in Washington in a couple of years' time.
NATO would be a very different.
And that is a real risk for us. So, I mean, I don't think we're advocating NATO in having a discussion around our security and defence policy. Absolutely. What we're having a discussion around is the triple lock. Do we really want the UN to have a veto over decisions about the deployment of Irish troops? I think that's completely wrong.
I think people hold the triple lock quite close, I think, in Ireland. I think peace...
Well, it's what got the last treaty, European treaty, over the line, let's remember.
It doesn't make sense. I think it doesn't make sense anymore.
I think it's easy in the situation that we're in at the moment in the world to have knee-jerk reactions and discussions, and it's no problem having debates or anything.
Well, just throw this into it, because this is, if you were down the pub tonight, there would be somebody on a stool saying, Katie, Ireland is Europe's back door. We are wide open. The Russians could mount an amphibious invasion of Ireland from the West. No one would be obliged to come to our aid because of our Mickey Mouse policy of neutrality. We should be in NATO and every other European defence pact.
So you will
hear that now, and it's something you hear now that you would not have heard, you know, a year ago.
I would counter that to say that there'll be another person on a bar still there saying that actually, you know, Ireland has peace building at its heart, and getting around a table with people that we actually don't want to be around the table with, and actually hammering out a deal. And you know, we've only seen it over the border and the conflict that we've had in our own island, that I think the world looks at us in a certain light. Things that our neutrality, I think, is held. It means a lot of things to a lot of people, I think. So having a debate about what it actually means to different people might be merited. But I think a lot of the polls have shown that, yes, people are in favour of supporting Ukraine, you know, calling out conflicts that have been provoked. But when it comes down to neutrality, it does seem to be a very hard line for a lot of people.
Just before we leave this, Ukraine, you've been following it obviously very closely, Tom, from as putting on your security analyst hat. Yeah. How are they doing? I mean, there's extraordinary news coming through in the last number of days.
There's a window closing now before winter gets in. Putin has lost the facts on the ground. Like, the Ukrainians are now imposing their will in Kherson, in Donbass, they're surrounding Lyman. They could create a pocket in which thousands and thousands of Russian troops are trapped in the next week or two.
Does that look like what they're strategically trying to do now? Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And they've got the initiative, they've got the momentum, and it's the same down around Kherson. And I suspect that before winter comes, that it's a very big ambition, but I suspect that Zelensky will try to close that land corridor that was created between Russia proper and Crimea in and around Mariupol. If they achieve that, the war, you know, Putin has effectively lost the war. And this is a very dangerous moment because, as you said, Barry, they're not a conventional threat, really, but they are an unconventional threat with the use of what they call low yield or tactical nuclear weapons. And that's the fear that Russia might be tempted to use a very small 1 kiloton thermonuclear device against a Ukrainian target to try and halt and to try and, you know, put an end to what they will say now is a threat on the Russian motherland.
And how will the rest of the world respond to that is the question.
Well, there's so many questions here. Would Putin order a nuclear strike? I think Russians fear that, but I don't think Putin does. Would he give the order? If he's sufficiently humiliated, then his position as president and his life is on the line. So I think he hypothetically could give that order. Would it be carried out? If it was, a 1 kiloton weapon would destroy a town like Athlone or Nina instantly. So it might be tempted to target Kramatorsk or Slavyansk, a town like that. The reaction from the West and from NATO would be instantaneous. It would be a dramatic escalation of the war. I'm told that the initial reaction would be a conventional one, but that there would be wave after wave of missile and airstrikes right across the Russian Federation, killing tens and tens of thousands of people. So let's hope we don't get to that point. But certainly at the moment, the initiative is with the Ukrainians, and Putin has destroyed the Russian military. He has destroyed the prestige and the reputation of Russia. And I feel sorry for Russians. I feel sorry for Ukrainians. The sooner this thing comes to an end, the better.
Well, hear, hear. We'll take a break there and we'll just talk about that discussion about Ukraine in the European Parliament after these.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And now just talking about Ukraine there before the break, there was a resolution passed in the European Parliament today condemning Russia's escalation of its war against Ukraine. But a number of Irish MEPs voted against that, Christina.
Left MEPs, Mick Wells and Claire Daly, voted against a certain paragraph 5 of that resolution. So it was calling on member states basically to support massively increasing military assistance in areas that have been requested assistance in Ukraine. And Mick Wallace, I think, Claire Daly and Luke Ming Flanagan supported an amendment that countered that proposal, which was calling for, you know, greater negotiation and dialogue and a peaceful resolution. So we had a number of other MEPs from the Fine Gael side and others that would have supported that resolution in the EU, but the left MEPs would have voted down that.
Yeah, and there was a lot of reaction to that. But I mean, they were saying, you know, that it was because it was calling mm-hmm. more weapons into the conflict zone, that it would put pressure on neutral states, that the sanctions are self-defeating, and they put forward all those reasons, but obviously a lot of pressure on them now for again taking up that position. I actually want to, just because there's only a few minutes left, I just wanted to talk to you about this European political community. Mm. Explain in a short sentence. What exactly is, because it's extraordinary to see Liz Truss in the middle of a...
Yeah, what it is, Macron has brought together leaders of all European states. So it's the EU27 plus Armenia, Azerbaijan, Turkey are there. Who are not there are Belarus and, you know, these. So the focus of discussion is on two things, energy and immigration, as it happens. And for Ireland, it is actually important because if for once we have an opportunity to be with the UK in the margins with our officials in a way that's been completely missing since the UK left the European Union. So it does serve that purpose for Ireland. It brings together, I mean, Armenia and Azerbaijan, you know, together in the one place. So it is, you know, at the moment, it's very difficult to see. There's no information about whether it's going to have a secretariat, whether it's going to have a budget, how decisions will be arrived at.
So was it's sheer force of will of Macron that actually got all these people
there.
Yeah,
and I think it's great that Liz Truss took the decision to actually get involved, because at the beginning it looked like she was going to, you know, she thought it was EU light or it was a way back to the EU and be looked at some way. But I think she quite rightly said and decided that it would look ridiculous and eccentric for the UK. Not that they don't look ridiculous and eccentric. If she didn't participate, so I'm glad that she went in the end.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, because it is an extraordinary gathering.
It's an unusual one for sure. One looking at it might look at it as a bit of a talking shop, given that perhaps there aren't the framework and the structure around it and what exactly it's going to achieve. But yeah, I think it's in light of maybe the situation that seems to be facing not just Europe, a whole range of other countries, the energy crisis, better to have everyone in one room hammering out some sort of solutions. We'll see if they actually come about or whether it is just a talking shop at the end of the day.
Rory?
But in fairness, it doesn't do any harm where we have everybody in and talking, and if we can get some sort of solutions. And obviously it's a chance for the Taoiseach and officials also that we can have that there's an absolute straight conversation around the Irish protocol and the fact that it is the only show in town. And I think not. We've heard better mood music from the British. We also know that there have been technical conversations with the European Commission. So we're just hoping that moves it on. And then in relation to that, it's also telling unionism that this is the only show in town. Streamlining is fine, but the Irish protocol is there to stay and that they need to get on with ensuring that there's an executive in the North.
Also, very quickly, John, the Taoiseach is saying today as well, look, maybe actually, acknowledging that the protocol, if it was fully implemented, is probably a bit too strict. And giving a bit of ground there, which I think is...
The good thing about the fact that the talks are back happening now is that can be teased out between both sides. And the important thing is that there seems to be a real willingness from the British side to engage with EU proposals that wasn't there last February. So I'm quite optimistic about that.
The Taoiseach's remarks are nothing new. It's implied in the fact that Sefcovic put four papers on the table that it can be
indeed,
tweaked.
But I suppose the point is that people need to hear these things and to hear them from
possibly, but there has always been flexibility from the European Union and the Commission. And I think this state here and the government need to get on with it as regards preparing for the reality of Irish unity and that conversation that's well developed.
I need to get on with it now because I am out of time.